So now on the Innovation Show, we welcome Adam Coleman, CEO of HR Locker. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Thanks very much.
So thanks for joining us. Let's talk about your backstory and how you set up the company, but what influenced you to do so.
Okay. I'm going to bore you for about 2 minutes, if you don't mind. I suppose my background initially was recruitment. Started off in London, came back to Ireland back in the early 90s. Worked in a recruitment company in the tech sector, really, probably for about 3 to 4 years, and got involved in a lot of serious startups in Ireland, like the startup of one or two of the Motorola plants and stuff like that, and various other technology stuff. But after about 4 or 5 years, I got bored because it was the same thing over and over again. And a company, small little company called ESET Digiphone, had won the second mobile license, and I got a year's contract, as it worked out, initially in Digiphone to help them to hire and to recruit. But I would only go there unless I would actually get the rest of the HR gambit to deal with. So anyway, I was there about 3 months and I was made permanent. And it's all history from that perspective in Digiphone. I suppose a lot of the work ethic I would have got would have been very, very much from there, with this sort of there's no such thing as can't happen. It will happen. So I was with them for a number of years up until we got taken over by BT. As everyone knows, it became O2. And then I went over to, after, I suppose, taking Digiphone from 0 to 800 people, then I went over to the UK and I became a head of commercial HR for what was old BT Sellit, which is O2 UK. Which was a different prospect, which I had to reduce their workforce from about 2,500 down to about 1,400 within a year and a half. So it was the ups and downs. Probably about a year and a bit into that, my mum got ill, and she was sole carer for my dad and for my sister. My dad had Alzheimer's, my sister was Down syndrome, and she had a stroke. So I had to get back to Ireland. So to be fair, O2 were fantastic to me at the time. And I came back and got settled. And my mum said to me, she says, look, you know, figure out where you want to live and develop a life around it. So we moved to Lahinch in County Clare because my kids were young, just about starting school. And I surf, so that helps, you know.
that's the way to clear the head.
Exactly. So when I got there, I had no idea what I wanted to do. All I wanted was a sleepy HR job on the west coast of Ireland, to be honest. And what happened was I realized very quickly that I'd walked out of sort of HR or business nirvana, where I was allowed to do whatever the hell I want, to HR in most companies is dealt with in a different way. So I started consulting. Before I knew it, I had to legitimize the company. So we started consulting, set up a consulting company called HR Interventions, or Interventions Group, or whatever you want to call it. And we had about 5 or 6 consultants running around the place like crazy, working with a lot of startups and some notable ones. The likes of Open Hydro, we would have done an awful lot of work with, who recently, I think about a couple of years ago, sold to DCNS for $178 million. If only they'd give me shares and yeah, paid me
instead of paying you. Yeah.
I wouldn't be talking to you.
When was this, Adam, just to put
that
context?
Was between 2004 and about 2007, 2008.
So it was before the kind of, because I suppose startup culture has kind of got very popular in the last 5 years or so, but this was back then, it was 10 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. Like when I arrived to Lahinch, the broadband, there was dial-up. It was taking me like 15 minutes to send an email. It was nuts, you know. And there was no reason why people thought I was crazy. They thought I was brave, and it was almost like, oh dear, oh, you know, oh, fair play to you.
poor hell, that.
Poor hell, that. Yeah, it was an element of that, yeah. And some of them actually thought I was setting up a surf school. I wasn't capable of setting up a surf school. I'm not that good at surfing. Yeah. But no, it was just a purely lifestyle thing. And having seen what happened to my mum, it was like, get yourself sorted. So around 2007, 2008, everything was going good. Realized that developing a consulting business was very difficult on the basis that consultants are expensive. And I was out winning all the business, and most of the clients wanted me to deliver it. So it was tough, you know. So I took my eye off the ball and I started to look at product. So we started to look at developing software. And we had this idea around this product called ExecPass. I won't bore you with it too much. It was like a validated version of LinkedIn for decision makers in business. We pumped a lot of money into it. We got a bit of help from Enterprise Ireland in terms of feasibility. But and when we got through, we did feasibility in Ireland, UK, Toronto and California. And the answer to the feasibility after 2 years was, yes, it would work, but you need 2.5 million. At that stage, recession had hit and there was very little money. And we were burning cash. So that got put by the wayside. But I met a guy called John Denny at the time.
John's on the show. Yeah.
Yeah. John Basie was the beginning of HR Locker.
Okay.
And John, myself and John worked together, and John got involved in the feasibility of Exec Pass early on. And when I was chatting to him, he liked my background. Two of us got on well. He surfs, I surf. We've actually never surfed together, but we talk about it a lot. And he liked, obviously, I had the HR background. I started helping him with some of the business analysis on it, and he asked me loads of questions, nothing formal. So what we did was we took a small reseller agreement because I thought this was a great product. So we started to resell the product, it's so reasonably priced. You weren't making a lot of money. To me, it was like it was helping me manage my clients.
So it was a SaaS product then. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So that was around.
Has to be reasonable.
Around 2010. Yeah. So around 2012, John calls me up one day and he says, "Adam, how are you?" I said, "Great." He says, "I'm thinking of closing down HR Locker," and I says, "Over my dead body." So anyway, long story short, I worked with John. We did a slow walk through it, agreed a price. I needed time to get developers and stuff on board. And by November 13, HR Locker was ours. But myself and John still talk at least once a month.
Yeah.
There's no...
That's great.
Yeah. So he's a great guy.
Yeah. You know, fantastic. And Zartis is his business at the moment, obviously.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if the truth be known, and John would hate me to say this, but the Exec Pass concept is now what he's doing in Zartis. So I took over his software. He took over my idea.
Yeah,
and I think he's making it work too, which is good.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. So, well, you're both succeeding, which is good news.
Absolutely. Yeah. So when we started, I know it sounds crazy to have a SaaS software company in Lahinch, but you can do it from anywhere. It builds the story. Like we're not all crazy surfing hippies down there. Our senior developer, Paul, is ex-surf instructor and developer. And there's myself, and there's eight or nine other of us as well running around the place. And it's working. The software is now basically live in 44 different countries. We've gone over the "we're going bust any day soon" bit, which is great. And and we're in a nice situation.
Your wife's happy with that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And we're also in a situation now where we spent the last 6 months becoming investor ready. But we don't really need investment. We need the right investor.
Yeah.
So we're not...
To fast track it.
Yeah. We're not in any major rush. If we get the right person, absolutely. And that's somebody who's either scaled a SaaS business before or somebody who can open doors with us around the world. Because Ireland and the UK are our major markets. Our markets work where the head offices are. And then they have offices all over the world. We've signed our first Vietnamese customer up last Friday, which was an interesting one. I have no idea how they found us. Google, I believe. Anyway, but
good SEO there, man.
Exactly. Yeah, we have to figure out exactly how it happened first.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah.
But so it's all good. We have a US market entry planned for Q4 of next year. We got Trinity MBA program to do a study for us. And we asked, I'm quite direct and quite straight. And I said, "Okay, guys, I know you have all the academic stuff to do, and I know you all want first, but I want to know where we go into the US, how we go in, and how much it's going to cost." So they looked at the culture of our business, they looked at everything we do, our sweet spot customer, et cetera, and they came back and they said, basically, Boulder, Colorado, Austin, Texas, San Diego, $160,000 for the first 6 months, and also basically that you need to get a partner and put one person on the ground to kick it off.
In the States?
Yes.
Brilliant.
So that's all good.
So when's that?
Hopefully Q4 next
Brilliant.
Year, about 2017, because the market, our sweet spot is companies with 5 to 500 employees, although we have bigger companies as well, but it allows them basically to hire, manage really cheaply, anything from €299 a year for up to 15 employees and going up to multiple thousands, obviously depending on the size of the company and the features that they take. But our sweet spot is tech, professional services, and non-for-profits, which is bizarre, but it's really working and they love our product.
And what does it solve? What problem does it solve?
It basically manages, it allows the entrepreneur, CEO, general manager, office manager, or team manager for that matter, to manage their people really, really simply. It manages all their holidays, all their absences, automates all of that sort of stuff. It manages all the employee data. So for instance, if Aiden is arriving into work and all of a sudden he moves house, he doesn't have to go to the HR department or somebody and tell them. He just goes online, just changes his address.
Brilliant.
Excuse me.
Because there's stuff there, but it's all fragmented. Like, I mean, it's who's off for managing your sick leave or that kind of stuff. And then there's nothing that brings it all together. And this is what HR Locker does.
Exactly. Brilliant. Yeah. So it manages. So if your pain point is training records, it manages that. But you don't have to have that as well as time off. So you can actually add the time off piece first. It has digital signatories, so you can actually send documents all the way around the world that can be automatically signed. And then there's the recruitment element. So it allows you to post the job. It goes straight to your Twitter feed, your LinkedIn feed.
From the software. Yeah. Brilliant.
Creates a careers page on your own website and also to 10 job boards for free. So, and they're all automatically answered and whatever. So it basically takes the pain out of managing people.
Yeah. It's not fragmented. It's actually just one.
All in one spot.
Brilliant.
And because we built it on the Microsoft Azure cloud, it's massively secure. We're adding features daily, improvements, whatever. And people don't even know that there's changes happening. So we have a roadmap, a technology roadmap, and which is probably stretches for 2, 3, 4 years of where things are going to. And because of my background in HR, we know where the market is going. Like, for instance, performance management is no longer in, you know, what's in. So we have a thing called EPE coming out in about a year's time, which will bring in a combination of artificial intelligence and will basically dispense with forms from a performance management perspective and get more involved in the engagement between the manager and the employee. Stuff like that, which no one else is doing currently. Now, it's going to be, it's 6, 9, 10 months away from our perspective because we're still a small organization, but it's definitely the way to go. On the other hand, some of our customers are saying, we want this. So we go into a development forum once a month and we knock off the stuff that they want, if you know what I mean, with no additional cost to them.
And what you were talking about, I suppose, some of the stuff they want, but what kind of trends are you seeing that leads to success? So what are the successful companies doing? Startups, for example, what are they doing that's different from the past that's actually really working that you've seen?
I know it's going to sound absolutely crazy. There's two types of companies. There's what we call progressive and control. Excuse me. You have companies who basically want to control their staff and want to monitor every single hour that they do. They're not the ones that are
successful. Sit at your desk style. Yeah. Be at your desk more often.
The ones that are really succeeding are the ones that really give employees an opportunity to express themselves under a framework. Do you know what I mean? Not, you can't obviously become, you know, the Indiana Jones of whatever world you're in, but like it's where they actually allow people and they listen to the employees and they get the employees involved and they drive it on. Do you know what I mean? And they give them a certain amount of control, you know. It depends on the sector. You know, if you're talking about pure innovation startup, they have to have that. They have to have a good leader. They have to have a good, and what I mean by leader is somebody who's not working 9 to 5, who's working probably all the time. And probably the first 5 or 6 people in any startup has to have that attitude.
Yeah. And their job, I suppose, is to set the culture and the vision. And, you know, you talked about the kind of maverick, the Indiana Jones. Mm. But like from what you see from an innovation perspective is the leader's job is to set out the North Star and go, look, this is where we're going.
Yeah.
And then everybody just goes and refers to that and kind of goes, is this going to get us there quicker? Yeah. Okay. I'm going to make that decision now and go for it.
Yeah.
So is that what you mean? That kind of mindset?
Yeah. But you also have to take into consideration, like, for instance, we're based in the Hinch and people say like, oh God, how do you get your talent to there or whatever? It's actually not that difficult. For a start off, we're offering a really nice place to live. So everyone talks about the millennials and they talk about this, that, and the other. At the end of the day, people want to work and live in a nice place, right? We've opened up an office in Manchester. And the reason we've opened up in Manchester is because if we need to attract talent, we can get talent in Manchester because there's a big tech scene over there. Plus the fact that it's actually quite a nice hub for us. For Shannon to Manchester is quicker from Lahinch to Dublin, and cheaper for that matter. But we obviously have a lot of ties to Dublin as well. Like we've partners in Dublin that if we wanted to put people in here, we could as well. But what we're finding is that our first hire in the UK was basically, he was in the UK for a short period of time. When he came over and he visited our office, now he's moved everything, wife, family, everything over to Lahinch. Because it's so much better to do that.
Lifestyle.
And, you know, you're not going to get the 25-year-old hipsters or 22-year-old hipsters coming out of Manchester, but by God, they love coming to Lahinch to chill out and stuff. So, you know, location is important, and how they work. We have two ladies who work with us in the office. Christelle has been with me for about 8 years. She has three kids under five. She works 15 hours a week. The 15 hours that she does is worth 30 to 40 hours of anybody else's.
It's so focused.
Yeah. Liz is ex-tester developer from Motorola in Cork. She was out of the workplace for 7 years, and she came back and worked with us, and she's head of our support now. And she works 25, 30 hours a week.
Mm.
And it's blending career, lifestyle, excitement, everything. And if you can get that, you don't have to be in Dublin. And actually, if you're in Dublin, it's almost counterintuitive to it. Do you know what I mean? Mm. If you're in Limerick or whatever. And so our story is slightly different. We're not trying to, we would love to have a lovely big tech surfing hub down in Lahinch, which it's getting there. I'm meeting the guy who set up Surf Office on the, actually, and John.
Oh, Daniel. Yeah. I met him. He was on the show. Yeah.
On the 22nd, he's coming down for a surf in Lahinch on the 22nd of September. So the fraternity around surfing and tech is really good, which is nice.
Yeah. I suppose it's the free mindset. You know, it's something that attracted me to Catawave, to join Catawave. That's the mindset is, you know, unlock potential in people, let them be free, because you'll get so much more back in the return. And it's like Christelle with the time, because you're going, okay, I'm doing this now, and you're just absolutely focused on that task, rather than FaceTime. And like you said, the two different types of companies, the one that makes people sit at their desk, I mean, the productivity there and the job satisfaction just means you're going to be slower doing the job. And you're probably writing strategy papers that are going to be put in someone's desk anyway.
Yes. And it's funny because I think Ireland is a bit slow to do that. I was at a company doing a leadership development program, developing behaviors to drive their business forward all this week. And they have a UK office as well. And the UK, their way of working is completely different. And it was back in sort of 2003 when I moved over there. I couldn't understand that a guy could actually be living in Dorset, but covering the London area. How the hell does that work? You know, it was alien to me as an Irish person, where traditionally was, you go to work, you go to see the clients, you do X, Y, and Z, but you go to work as in the office. So that opened my mind to a lot of that sort of stuff. And I think a lot of Irish business still haven't quite got that. I think the new wave tech businesses, stroke new business setting up, have.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to make a huge difference.
Because even stuff like PA work, I mean, you don't need to be in the office to do that work. I mean, that's ridiculous. Like, you're managing schedules, you're managing administration work, etc., the executive assistant stuff. Yes, if you're hosting guests coming into an office, etc., but if it's actually those kind of tasks, that can be done from anywhere.
We have a couple of workers who work with us on and off. There's a marketing person who is in South Africa. There's a person who did our voiceovers for One Element who is in Israel. And you know, we've somebody who does some work for us in the Philippines. It doesn't really matter. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Once it fits with their lifestyle, because work has changed. Work has changed completely. The 9-to-5 stuff isn't there anymore. It might be 9-to-2. It could be 2-to-12. It doesn't really matter. You know, people aren't going to have jobs for the age of 18 until 65. They'll probably have 5 to 6 different careers in their life.
You know?
So it's the whole thing has changed.
And that's interesting, because that mindset of changing careers more often. I mean, we had Kingsley Aiken on the show before, and he talked about this, that like our children will have up to 18 careers, because they'll move every 2 years to do, and it'll be almost project-based work. So they need to have an expertise that can be brought around from company to company in project-based work. Have you seen evidence of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm classic evidence of it. Yeah. I started off as a recruiter, went into in-house HR, ended up as a HR stroke management consultant, and now I'm running a software business.
Mm.
What do I know about software? Very little. I know enough to run the company, and I have very good software developers, you know, who work with me. I think everything is changing, you know, and I think the traditional scenario, and it pains me this time of year when people are getting their CEO, and I talk to friends of mine's kids, and even friends of mine will say, Johnny is going to do medicine, or or he's going to do accountancy, let the kid off and do something that he learns something.
Yeah.
Because most, the amount of kids I know who do, and guys my age who are spend 5-6 years in college, by year three, they realize I'm doing the wrong thing. And by the time they're 40, it's too late and they're doing, you know, they're that accountant or that actuary that's sitting there and they shouldn't really be doing this, you know. But there's people have to learn and then decide on what they want to do.
Yeah. It's interesting that there's a great saying that if you're going to climb to the top of the ladder, make sure it's against the right wall.
Yeah,
and you know, you see it like, because when you have to make a decision, like some people are as young as 16, 17, 18 to decide what you're going to do in college, you don't have a clue.
Mm.
And you know, you've seen evidence that kind of arts or kind of a mix of arts and science is the right decision, because at least you can be getting a broad kind of skill set and then make a decision afterwards for an expertise.
Yeah, it depends on the person too. To bring it back to reality, like I was an ex-recruiter, I was an in-house HR person, and now I'm involved in the mechanisms for recruitment. And you know, when I was a recruiter, I had to hire what the client wanted. When I ended up in-house in ESET Digiphone, it was a different ball game. We didn't hire for tech skills. We hired by attitude. Customer-focused, teamwork, and flexible.
Flexible.
That was basically it. And if you weren't acceptable on those three behaviours, you didn't get hired.
And that's really interesting. How did you, because I did, anytime I've hired, hire for attitude, train for skills.
Yes.
And how did you untangle that? How did you identify those people? Like, what were you looking for on their CVs or in the questions you asked?
Well, it started out, we were lucky and unlucky in some ways. In the early stages, what happened was there was a couple of areas that were very difficult to find. Radio engineers were impossible. The only people that you could get to radio engineering were either ex-military or contractors who were earning a lot of money. We were lucky enough at the time to be part owned by Telenor. So they sent over 8 radio engineers from Norway, and we were trying to figure out how the hell we would get around this. So what we did was we made a decision that we would hire 2 graduates and tack them to each radio engineer for a year, right? So we went out to the marketplace and we hired graduates, and we looked at, well, where nobody is doing radio engineering properly, with the exception, actually, interesting enough, of Letterkenny RTC at the time, who had a diploma program. So what we did was we went on the milk round, and we disrupted the milk round, because the likes of Aircom would come in and they'd say, right, we only want firsts. And by the way, if you get a first class honours degree, you get, I think it was 15 grand. If you get a second class, you get 14 grand and whatever. So I remember standing in front of the guys in DIT in Kevin Street and in UCD, and they say, well, what do we need to get to get into Digiphone? I said, you don't need anything. Once you have your degree, I don't care. If it's passed, don't really care. You'll get an interview. So we interviewed everybody. We had this stringent scenario of, as you said, we hired for attitude, because we could teach them anything, because we had these 8 radio engineers from Norway who were brilliant. So we hired literally 16 engineers, graduates. And those guys have gone on, like, we ended up having probably the best radio engineering probably in Europe, if not the world. And a lot of those guys have gone on and have set up companies like Villicom and various people afterwards. They were an amazing group of people. So we didn't really know what we were doing. We had a plan. We were using behavioral interviewing, and we got it right.
Mm.
Maybe some people say lucky, but we got it right.
But on the behavioral interviewing, what kind of triggers? So for example, you know the way a lot of people, tech companies, will look for somebody who founded and failed in a company, or they're looking for some type of bad experience that they overcame, or some type of a failure in a company, or getting through that, or you know, some type of kind of element.
Yeah.
So some stuff that they just went, I got over and I bounced back.
Well, it's in recruitment, and the right way to do recruitment, I call it selection as opposed to recruitment, right, is past performance is the best predictor of future behavior.
Okay.
No question. There's 3 things to be taken into consideration. Your past performance, there's your preferences, which you can use with psychometrics, and then there's a thing called motivational fit. And avoid that at your peril. And what motivational fit means is that if the actual the type of company in the area and what you're going to pay them in the location, and the values of the company are consistent with what the person wants at that moment in time. Okay. Yeah. So if you take those three things into consideration, in terms of the behavioral piece, you're asking very, very serious questions on the basis of, tell me about a time when you did X, Y, and Z in this company. What did you do? Sorry, what was the situation? What did you do? And what was the result of it? And the most important piece of information here is, what did you do? Be it a negative question, a positive question. So you're learning what they've done, not what most people...
Not what was their job spec.
Yeah, we talked yesterday with this company, and I asked them about how did they interview. And it says, oh, well, what we do is we'd ask them, what would you do if? But if somebody asked me, what would you do if? I'm going to tell you what I think you want to hear.
Yeah.
But if you ask me, tell me about a time when I did X in company Y, which is like the target job, then I have to give you an example.
Yeah.
So it's real life stuff. And then you basically analyze that and you decide if it's acceptable or if it's not. If it's most relevant, if it's the most recent, it's better. If it's most like the target job, it's better. If it holds the most impact, it's better. And then you have real, real stuff to make a decision.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing around the interview and stuff, and I go on about this a lot because it's the only thing I really know anything about. The rest of it I'll make up. The interviewing part is like, if you get to the situation that you have all of this material, people normally say, oh, we've hired them, and they put it away. That's his or her first appraisal. When they arrive in the business, you take out the interview notes, you sit down and say, we've interviewed you against these behaviors. This is how you got on. We weren't sure about this, so let's start your development plan from here. You'll blow the employee away.
Yeah.
And you're using all of this.
Brilliant.
To coin a term, big data, right? Mm. Or small data, as John Hurley from Ryanair called it. And you're using the information, because an interview is the first appraisal that you're going to have with a person.
Yeah.
And it's the same skills you use in interviewing, you know?
I love that. So you see somewhere where they might have had a failure or near failure, and you're kind of going, we're going to help you here.
Yeah.
Straight away, you've got buy-in. I love that. I never heard of that before.
Yeah. I think the most important thing is that you really relax a person at interview. And no different than the interview we're having here, I'm quite relaxed. I'm telling you exactly I'm not making anything up. I'm just telling it straight. Interviews are really, really formal scenarios. Make them as relaxed as possible. People will tell you stuff when they're relaxed. If you hype them and they're stressed, you're not going to get the proper stuff out of them at all. You know, so keep them relaxed and empathize with them. Have a chat with them. They will say things that they will drop their guard. They'll say things that they would normally do. And that's it. Putting people under pressure in interviews, there's no point.
Yeah.
The only way that there's a thing called assimilation. When you're looking at past performance predicting future behavior, you can actually look at present behavior. So what you do in that situation, if you want to set up assimilation, so what you do is you set up what they'd actually be doing in the job, but you simulate the job as best you possibly could. So for instance, if you were a sales guy selling to a telco company or something like that, you would give them all the information beforehand, give them a week to prepare, because that's what they would normally do. And then you say, okay, you're going to go in there, you're going to meet a buyer, you're going to meet the tech guy, you're going to meet whatever, here's their background. And then you see how they do in that real-time environment, okay? So that's similar. That's when you're assessing real-time work. Some companies go down that route as well.
Because on that, right, and I'm sure so many of the startups who listen to this show, they don't have the time to do that or the expertise. But you see so many companies, and big companies, hiring quickly. And, you know, and they wonder why there's a large turnover, because the fit might not be there.
I don't think it takes that long. I'm not being smart.
Okay.
But if you learn about behavioral interviewing, go on a one-day program, literally, and whether it's with us or somebody else, it doesn't really matter. Go on a one-day program. Understand what your core behaviors for your business. Set out your core behaviors for your business, and you'll use it in every part of your business. You'll use it to exemplify what you're like as a company. You'll use it in-house. It'll be a language that you can talk to your employees about, all that sort of stuff. Then you develop questions around those core behaviors, and then you have your interview guide. And you just replicate the interview guides. And then what you do is you make sure that people know how to interview properly. And then basically, so it's no longer, once you do that setup, the setup is probably about 2 days, right?
But it's a template then.
Yeah. And you just drive it on from there. There's no magic to it. It's a skill. It's like, if you have the best sales manager in the world, he doesn't have a God-given right to hire the best salesperson. It's a skill. He needs to learn it like everything else. But there's this idea, it's the, you know, Socrates in general. Socrates is probably my hero because he knew more than everybody else because he knew what he didn't know. Okay, obviously he got killed on the back of it, but that's neither here nor there. but the whole point of it is that I know what I don't know. And if I don't know something, I go out and find it out. Be that interviewing skills, be that, for instance, I'm not a developer, so therefore I've got good developers, if you know what I mean. And people say, oh, you're CEO of HR Locker, you must know an awful lot about development. It was like in Digiphone, a lot of the engineers thought I was an engineer. And I remember one situation, being in the 51 and having a couple of drinks with someone, said, you'd understand on because you're an engineer. I looked at him and I said, listen, mate, if you put a girl's locker there and a DMS 100 switch, the only reason I'd be able to tell one from the other is I presume the DMS 100 switch would have flashing lights. So it's your ability to seek out the proper information and not make it up.
It's funny. It reminds me of that saying, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room.
Yeah.
You know, so, but, so it's, you know, having the chat with you, you can understand, you know, you said, you know, nothing about software, but it's the mindset behind the software. And we had, Dennis Mortensen, who's CEO of a company called X.AI. So it's an AI agent, which is a PA.
Yeah.
Basically I use it. It's a fantastic product. But Dennis has a great saying that he said, in today's world or tomorrow's world, it's not about the answers. So you can get the answers from AI and you can get all that kind of thing, but it's about the questions. And you can really see that with you, Adam, that you're right, asking the right questions. And then with that mindset of, I don't know how to code, but I get the best coders.
Yeah.
They're just putting those questions together into a product, which has become HR Locker.
Yeah, exactly. It's I must admit, if I came back from the UK and I stayed as a consultant, people would say this to me and they'd say, God, you could be under 120, 140 grand a year or whatever. It's not even about the money. For me, it's about building something and enjoying the build and enjoying the journey. And I think most entrepreneurs, if an entrepreneur is focused on cash, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
You know, they have to really love what they're doing because it ain't 9 to 5. It drives my wife nuts.
Of course.
We have 600 square foot of office on the front of our house. My office links directly to our house, right? Corridor. Once I walk in there, I'm at work. Once I walk out, I'm still at work. Do you know what I mean?
Of course.
But it gives her the idea that I'm not at work, which is good, you know? and I have the right balance for me. I'm not so sure if it's for her, but it is obviously now we're married a long time and we ain't going anywhere fast. So it's a situation where you have to, as an entrepreneur, you have to mold it to the way that you want it and you have to be selfish.
Mm.
It's really interesting. We do a lot of work with psychometrics and we're licensed practitioners with Insights and I love Insights and I've met Andy Lodian loads of times and I've even redeveloped their interview chapter for them, even though they don't use it and we're the only ones who use it. But my wife is my direct opposite, okay? And to give you an example, when we did it with psychometrics initially back in the early days, my idea of looking after the family is providing for them. So it's obviously earning cash to be able to provide for them. Her idea of looking after the family is spending time with them. So they're two very, very different things. But once you actually know they're different, then you can actually cope with that sort of stuff.
Where can people find...
If you go to www.hrlocker.com and... if you go on and there's a 14-day free trial, as soon as you pick up the trial, you start the trial, one of the guys will call you and have a chat with you before you even kick off the trial so you get full value on it. And there's no obligations whatsoever. So by all means, try it out.
Brilliant. Well, Adam Coleman, CEO of HR Locker, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.